The undiscovered black country, the folks don't seem to know. The undiscovered black country, where everyone should go. People walk or cycle round, they pass the time of day. The undiscovered black country has places tucked away.
I was walking up the top of Raleigh Bonk, just the back of where I live. I just found it the most peaceful and wonderful place to walk. You go up the top of the fields, the back of Portway Hill, climb right up onto the top, and go where there's a little flat bit at the top, really, and you can see this wonderful panoramic view of Brummagem, and then right to the left, as far as the eye can see, right to the right, Clenton, all that, and turn around and see Sedgley. And it puts you in a very reflective mood. And I've never told the story, the full story before, of my lady, Susie. And while I was up there, I just got thinking about hair, which I do, you know, a lot, really. It's probably now 2007, so that's 15 year that she passed away. But the journey that she went upon was such a wonderful, wonderful journey. And everything I do now, I think, is probably a reflection of obviously the period before that, before she was diagnosed with cancer, but certainly the period while she had cancer. And I think it might be important to tell the story in relation to people who might, you know, might be diagnosed or are on a journey and feel down and stuff, because a classic saying was, and it was 12 year or more, that and I ain't going to say fought, I'm just going to say was married to cancer, in a way, because there was never a fight as such. It was an acceptance and a decision that really changed her life and everybody's life that knowed her. So I'm going to tell you the story as much as I can remember, and some of the funny things that happened, and some of the ways that it shaped her as well as a person. And I wouldn't ever say that I lost a battle to cancer, because in the final days, Susie made her own decisions as what was going to happen, and we'll get to that. Any road up, we'd been married a while, and we'd got some young kids, and Susie had a tendency to have a lot of cysts on her breasts, and it would go to the GP, and it'd be, "Susie, it's a cyst." Well, this one day, I'll come home from work, and I says, "I've got a lump on my breast," and I can't remember which one, to be honest, I can't remember which one. And I said, "Oh, it's probably a cyst, go up and see the doctor and you'll get it sorted." I says, "Nah, Ty." And I said, "What do you mean, Ty?" I says, "It's different." And I said, "Well, how is it different? You have loads of them." And he went, "Oh, no, it's different. I'll go to the GP, but I need to be referred." So we went to the GP, got referred. We went to Sandwell and seed a doctor called Dr. Ellis, who initially put her back up, to be honest. But eventually they become so tight, and he come to the funeral and he cried his eyes up. And he was a wonderful bloke. But we went in, and Susie, I suppose it's really, I should explain that Susie was then 40, and I was going into that period where women decide what the next 30 years of the life was going to be. So it was, you know, it was a financial advisor at the Halifax, and a great job and all that. But it was, I think mentally, it was like, well, I'm going to grow up with my kids and blah, 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 and this is going to be the life. And so this is how it changed, really. So we were sat there, and Dr. Ellis examined her and the history from the GP, and he said, so you have a lot of cysts? And I went, yeah, but this acyst. And he went, how do you know? And he says, because I know. And he said, but it probably is a cyst, Mrs. Dakin. At first he used to call her Mrs. Dakin, after it was Susie. And he says, but it a cyst, I know. And he said, look, I don't think that we need to take a biopsy, but if it'll satisfy you, we'll take a biopsy. But I can probably guarantee that it's a cyst. And I said, you can guarantee all you like, but it's a cyst, I'll tell you that now. Anyway, I had the biopsy done, and about 2 days later, there was a phone call. I think we were at home at the time, and Dr. Ellis was crying. And he said, I'm really, really sorry, and I need to apologise and all this. And he says, but it is cancerous and quite advanced and quite fierce, the cancer, so you need to come in as soon as possible, and I'll refer you to... and I think it was Miss Finch was the surgeon, and we'll work together, he says, and decide what to do. But obviously, the decision will be now with Miss Finch and the oncology department, etc., etc., etc. So we come and see this Miss Finch, lovely woman, lovely wench. Had all the reports, and I said, Susan, it's quite aggressive in your right breast, say, but it's also shown up from the mammogram that you've got precancerous cells in your left breast. And Susie says, so what does that mean? And he said, well, there's a 100% chance that it will develop in your left breast, and it could be 3 months, it could be 10 years, but it will develop. And she said, so what's the best thing to do then? And she said, the decision is entirely yours. Obviously, you'll have to have chemo after. There's also a couple of the lymph nodes under the arm that need to be checked out. So what we would do is I would remove the breast. Then you can either have prosthetics or I can do a reconstruction. So Susie said, so why not take them both? And she said, well, that's a very drastic decision. And I think about it. I was sat there thinking, oh, my God, what's it doing now? Because as a bloke, you don't know. You don't know if it's going to change the way you are and you know, and everything that you've got to go through. And later on, we found out that it did change a lot of relationships when we used to go to the clinics, which I'll tell you about later on. But any road up, they decided that that's what they'd do. And Susie was wore that well blessed, and I said, you know, when you do your reconstructions, and I went, ah, oh. I says, can you just give me, you know, slightly bigger pap-aps? And Dr. Finch says, you can have them as big as you want, it don't really matter. I says, no, I don't want them big, I just want them bigger than they am, slightly bigger than them. Ah, oh, I said. So the decision was made that she would have a bilateral mastectomy and reconstruction, and then go straight on to chemo to blast her body, take these lymph nodes out, completely blast her body, radiotherapy under her arm, all that sort of thing. And then I said, don't you want to save your nipples? And Susan said, I beg your pardon? And I said, don't you want to save your nipples? Or do you want us to put plastic nipples on afterwards? And he went, well, how will you do that? I said, well, when we do the mastectomy, we take your nipples off and we sew them into your groins, because then it's got a blood supply. And then when we know that there's no trouble with the breasts and the reconstruction, we'll put them back. And Sue says, ah, if that's the best way of doing it, then do it. And I'm going, you want your nipples in your groins? And he goes, well, is that a problem? And I went, no, not really. I'm just here, just listening to it, and I'm just totally gobsmacked by everything that's going on. So I had bilateral mastectomy, nipples were sewed in the groins, start had 21 sessions of radiotherapy under her arm, which completely destroyed the nerve cells in her left arm and caused a problem with lymphedema later on. And they did have to have other lymph nodes took out later on. But that was the start of it. And then we went to see the mad professor, Dr. Spooner, who was head of the oncology department. And he said, what we're going to do, we're going to have to blast you with a cocktail of chemotherapy. And this is what's going to happen. And it was horrendous. Air falling out, nails dropping off, ulcers in your throat and your mouth. Everything you could think of. And Susie says, all right then, you know, let's do it. And already, Ed been on like the internet and stuff like that, researching all the trial drugs that they were using in America and stuff like that. Because he was thinking, if they say they call doom now, I'm just going to say, stick me on this. And I could see the change in her in terms of the positivity of self, really, if that's how I can explain it to you. So I started this chemo. Never, ever get up work. Never, ever get up work. And sometimes I just could not move. I mean, her hair started to fall out straight away. Her nails went black and they dropped off. I'd got these really big ulcers under her lips and in her gums, and that I could hardly swallow. And I never made a murmur. And I'd go into the clinics, you know, what they had to do at the Halifax, because then obviously your chemotherapy lowers your resistance. They had to take her off the shop floor, for want of a better word, interviewing, and they had to stick her up in the room where they did all the money. So if somebody was on the cash desk and they needed 500 quid, they sent this little casket up and then they put the money in back down. That's where I think everything changed, because I met a wench called Donna who become a soulmate. And they, you know, they were like thicker than sisters. And they used to play Mariel up. By then, Sue would... I wouldn't wear a wig unless I was, you know, going out somewhere posh, I suppose, or going up to Broad Street, which I'll tell you about later on. I just used to put a scarf on, Halifax scarf, and I looked stunning, absolutely stunning. Well, anyway, they'd be up there and they'd be chatting about, you know, the various positions and what Donna's family and all that, and they got really, really tight. But they'd do things like, they'd get a request for 200 quid. So they'd stick a Mars bar in and send it down. And of course the cashier would be there, and then this tin would open and they'd pour it out for this customer's money. And a Mars bar would put out with a little note from Susie and Donna. And the customers had loft their head up, and the wenches on the tills had loft their head off. And it had just become known that the terrible twins was upstairs. And I worked there for a while. Donna used to come to our house and I'd stay over and stuff like that. And Donna was going out with certain blokes, and Susie would say, he's no good for you, and he's no good for you. Don't go with him. And eventually I sort of hooked Donna up with a husband now, Martin, because I just thought he was the right one. What used to happen is I used to say, I'm going to live my life. Her hair come back a little bit the first time, and I just left it really short, never let it grow long. It was beautiful, and I'd dye it like a purpley colour or something or whatever. Completely changed the way I dressed, the way I did things. And we was like a home for all the kids. I mean, my babs had a circle of friends of about 30, and they used to come all the time to our house, these kids. Wonderful, wonderful kids. They still know them now. They still go out with them now. And we was their auntie and uncle, and very often when they were old enough to start going out to the clubs, we'd get up on a Saturday morning for work and they'd be lying in the lounge, and we had to do like 26 bacon sandwiches before we went to work. But they were beautiful. And we sat down with them and our kids, explained what was going to happen, and they were wonderful. They said, well, don't worry about it, because we're here like Auntie Sue and Uncle Brian, you know, we're always here, and we're here for Ruth and Gemma, and we're here for you. And I treasure that to this day. I really do treasure that to this day. So that first lot of chemo was probably the worst slot, and things happened like there was an infection in the left breast and I had to have the implant out and it had to stop out for 6 months. There was more infections in the lymph nodes and I started to get the first stages of lymphedema where your arm swells up, so I had to wear like a tight piece of elastic upper arm, a left arm first, a right arm later on. But I wore one. I mean, we go away on holiday as a family and stuff like that. I wore one for a day drink. So I wore one for bars and I wore one for beaches and sitting around pools and stuff like that. And Sue, we sat down one night and Sue says, look, what I'm going to do is when I feel that I need to do something, I shall ask you first. But if you don't want to do it, I'm doing it. End of story. And I said, Susie, you do whatever you need to do. And some people, they understand that because they thought, well, your missus has got cancer. You should be with her every second of the day. But it don't work like that. I mean, for some it does. And if that's what you got to do, that's what you got to do. But to me, I'd be putting the mockers on everything because Susie would know that our day really want to lie on the beach or our day really want to sit in a bar and have a drink and stuff like that. I'd sooner go to art galleries or walk around towns or go for long walks and stuff like that. Well, I couldn't do that because what it did do, it made her incredibly tired. So I made that decision and we agreed that. And the mother particularly used to say to her, Susie, you shouldn't go away without Brian because, you know, it's wrong. And I'd go, why is it wrong? You don't want to come. And Donna's coming with me anyway. So that's that. So very often, what they started to do at first was there was a ritual of going up to Broad Street. On Fridays, I'd have a chemo. And sometimes I'd be there 4 or 5 hours. I'd come out to work. And I'd work over. I'd work through a dinner hour and all that. And it didn't matter how rubbish I felt. I'd work. And I'd be back on the desk then. Folks would bring her boxes of chocolates and I'd go to the nth degree, you know, to listen to people's problems, damn it, what had got herself. They made this pact that they'd go to Broad Street on a Friday night. So they'd get all dolled up with my daughters and some of her mates and everything and off they'd go. And I always used to say to her, look, if you don't feel well, I'd drop them off. If don't feel well, you phone me and I'll come and fetch you. Otherwise, it'd be 2 o'clock in the morning and I'd go and park by the Novotel just off Broad Street and I'd see them coming up singing and they're dancing all on them. And the foulest smelling Turkish kebabby things that the taxi drivers wouldn't have them because this stuff stunk that much that they were eating. And then sometimes we'd get home and they'd be sat there chatting on the landing, leant against the wall, and I'd say, well, I'm going back to bed. Don't forget your booth got work in the morning. And I'd get up in the morning and I'd still be there, asleep on the landing. And I'd bang around and go, come on, you two, come on. But they'd go to work. I'd never miss work. It was fantastic. Or I'd get home on a Friday night from work and the cases had been in the hall and I'd say, oh, we were going now, and I go, we're going to because it had a pretty bad week and stuff like that. We're going to Dublin for the weekend, or we're going to Tenerife for 3 days, you know, all this that was going on. And I'd say, fantastic. And folks would say, well, what do you do? And I'd say, well, obviously I worry about her, but it's what her wants to do. And if I was there, I wouldn't have such a great time as I would with Donna. And Donna's a soulmate, you know, they're through thick and thin. And that's how it went on for a time. There was probably a couple of years where I was having chemo and the other implant was put back in, and things were going well, and it was like coming, the figures were coming down, and we thought it was all right. And then I had a lump on the back of a neck, and it had transported to a neck, and I had to have another operation. And we'd go to the clinic, and by now Dr. Spooner would call her Susie, because it was funny, really. The clinic was funny because he knew what I was like now, and I wouldn't stand no messing, and he'd be talking to her about something that couldn't be possible and all that, and I'd just bring a file out, and he'd go, "Oh, not the file," and he'd go, "Well, I've read this report from the Chicago University in America, and da 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 da, so I know this can be done, so you better do it." But it wore on you that. You'd be sat in the waiting room and somebody'd come out and they'd look a bit down and go, "What's the matter?" And he'd go, "Well, he said this and this," and he'd knock the door. And he'd open the door and he'd go, "Yes, Mrs. Dakin. You've just told that wench this. It's saying that's wrong. You need to go and sit and explain it because her husband and all that." And he just knew. But he absolutely loved her to death. Absolutely loved her to death. But earlier on, I was talking about relationships, and how we thought this was the best way of working with it, working with this disease. But we see loads of women that would come with their husbands to start with, and then, you know, after a period of time, the blokes were there, and then Susie would get to talking to them, and they'd say, "Oh, we've split up because of this or because of this," because they couldn't handle it. And from a bloke's point of view, I can sort of understand it. From a physical point of view, if you, and particularly if they die of reconstructions, if your missus is badly scarred, obviously. Also, the psychological thing of seeing your missus with no hair and, you know, black nails or nails that are full, it could be incredibly difficult. And I saying that, you know, that these blokes was right, because they were right. You know, you've got to be there. And particularly for your kids and everything, everything's got to be solid, and everything's got to be done together, in a sense. Every decision has got to be made together. And I think that's the crux of it. And it's all got to take over your life. You've got to make sure that don't take over your life. And Susie certainly did. He used to say to me towards the end, "This has been the worst and best 12 years of my life, because I've been a new person for 12 years. And it's true. And the kids' mates had come, and they'd love her to death, and they'd go out with him shopping and everything. And it was like the elder sister, had I become a mother as such? Had I become a mid-40s mother? Had I become the mate, the friend? And I thought that was incredibly important. They changed the chemo two or three times. I had to have rest for it for 6 months, and that's the worrying time if somebody has got a cancer that's developing, because that time, even though the toxins are still in your body, there's a chance that the cancer can like lock on somewhere else, and it did. And we got a call from Dr. Spooner, and because he used to have periodical, obviously, scans and stuff to see if everything was all right. And he called me in and he said, "It's in your liver." And Sue says, "Oh, so take it out." And he said, "Well, we can't do that." And she says, "What do you mean? You called me?" And he said, "Well, it's secondary breast cancer in the liver. It's not liver cancer." I says, "I don't care." And he said, "But Susan, what you got to understand is, if it's liver cancer, it's there, isolated in the liver. Here, now, it's come from the breast and the other things that you've had, your lymph nodes on the back of your neck and such like. Your lymphedema is getting worse. It's coming through in your legs now. And this is all part and parcel of it." So, and I said, "I don't agree with you." And he says, "But we've never done this." And I said, "So, you're denying women like me the chance of extra few years by not doing this operation Why do you do it to me? If it don't work, I've got nothing to lose. You know, I'm going to pop my clogs. But if it works, then you can do it for other women. You can offer it for other women. And he says, well, it ain't my decision. I said, well, whose is it then? He says, well, it's the surgeon in the unit at the QE. Fair enough, he says. Send me to him. I'll sort it out. And he knew, in the back of his head, he knew what he'd do. And we got this appointment with this bloke. I can't remember his name. Got this appointment with this bloke at the QE. And, you know, and I never stopped. It was like out gallivanting down Broad Street. They were off like Tenerife, Mallorca. Dublin was a favourite. Dublin was a favourite. It was like, it was something in a soul with her and Donna that they just absolutely adored Dublin. And they come back almost regenerated. It don't matter how crap I felt. It almost regenerated. We used to have annual parties at our house where we'd have, I mean, it were a big house, but we'd have like 200 folk in our house, in the garden and everywhere, and we'd do Audrey plays in Black Country and folks would take parts and stuff. And it was just, it's really difficult to describe how it changed our lives for the better, in a way. Because it made us so positive and also made us understand so many people's journeys, in a way, all these people who are being treated and otherwise. We goes up to the QE and we're driving. I'm going, Susan, please don't make a fuss. And has got a file out and everything. And we've filed in and this big noise surgeon sat there. And he was a bit patronising to start with. And he was going, let me just explain, Mrs. Dakin, let me just explain what this means. And I went, I just looked him dead eyed and I went, you know, explain to me, I know everything. And I'm talking like I talk, but her day, because Susie was posher than me and spoke really well. And I very often used to say to her, you know, I don't know why you ever puck me to get married to. And I'd say, will you make me laugh? And that was all I'd say. Will you make me laugh? And that was just, I used to drive her to Rack and Ruin. I used to, you know, I could pull her hair out. Well, when I had it, I could pull her hair out with me. But anyway, so we sat there and I says, you don't have to explain anything to me. All you got to explain to me is why you can't do this operation. And he went, you know, it's secondary breast cancer and it's now in your liver. And I said, don't agree with you. This is a chance for you to do something new that might give a chance to women that come after me. And if it don't work, you don't do it again. If it works, you've got the option to give to women to do it, are you? So, you know, I leave in this office, doctor, whatever your first name is, I can't remember him, until you decide I'm going to do it. And it must have been about, and he was going on, and Susie would get out a book and go, hang on here, let me point out to this case in so-and-so. And it was about 2 hours, and he picked up the phone, and he said, David, that was Mr. Spooner's first name. Yes, you could hear me. You know, he'd got it on loudspeaker or wherever it was. Mrs. Dakin is here with Mr. Dakin. Yeah. And we've been discussing the reasons why we can't do this operation. Yep. Yeah. And you could hear from his deadpan replies that he was thinking, you've lost, mate. I tell you that now, you've lost. And he said, but you won't leave the office. And he went, no, I suppose not. And he said, so what do you reckon I should do? And he said, well, it's your decision. You own the surgeon, but you're going to be there a long time if you don't agree to do this operation. So he agreed to do this liver operation, Fuston, that he'd done on secondary breast cancer. And he took about 80% of Susie's liver away. The scar was unbelievable. It was like from a breastplate. And then it went out in almost like a reverted band the bomb sign. And it must have been about 15, 16 inches in this like inverted V shape. But they used it. Aaron and Donna were absolute buggers, I tell you now. They used to just play folks up when they went up to Broad Street. And the one story, and I'll tell you the story, there was two young students. Because they both looked, you know, hot totty when they were out. And two young students, one was chatting Donna up and one was chatting Susie up. And they made their excuses and went to the toilet. And Susie says, "We'll have these. We'll have these two lads." And Donna says, "What?" And says, "We're going to do this. Bloody, bloody, blah." So when you've primed Yowen, bring him over. All right. And they said, "Yeah." So Susie goes back and is talking to this thing, this lad. And Donna winked and brought this chap over. And this chap says, "Is that right? Yowen was bitten by a shark." And he went, "Oh, yeah. On the Barrier Reef in Australia, we were like snorkeling, me and Donna. Went on holiday and then this shark just almost ripped me innards out, but I survived." And he went, "Oh, come off it." This other bloke says, "Ah, can't believe that." And I says, "Well, here are then." And they lifted the front up and this scar was there. And this young lad went, bump, on the floor in the sports bar in Brummagem. And another time, this one bloke come up with a right chat-up line and he went, because I did wear a wig sometimes when I went to Broad Street and had this spiky wig on. Looked fantastic. And this bloke says, "I tell you what," he says, "I love your hair." So I just took a wig off and giddied him and says, "Here then, you'll try it on." And this bloke was there, like, stood in the sports bar with a wig in her hand. Anyway, I had this, I'm diverting, but I mean, there's so many stories, so many stories that I could tell that were just one, well, I've got them. You know, they're my memories. They'd always be my memories, and I've got them, and I treasure them. And I just laugh out loud sometimes. And me and Donna are so close, and Donna is really close to Ruth, my daughter. They are soulmates now, and her lads are like my sons. So that's another thing that's another bonus of this journey. Anyway, had a liver done, continued with some treatments, went on to this drug called Herceptin, was supposed to be the saviour of everything it wore, but I went on it, a fun out about it, and you're only supposed to be on Herceptin for 6 months, but I'd been on it for about, God knows, loads and loads and loads of times. And for about a year, things were bad. I mean, it was still poorly. It was still having treatment. A lymphedema was getting worse. And now would be sitting watching the telly. And we had to have a towel on the floor because the legs would ooze of this white gooey stuff. And you'd have to wipe them down every now and then. So it wore ideal. But it was all right. And then we had a call back from one of the scans that I had done. And went in to see Dr. Spooner, and he was ashen. He was ashen white, I tell you. And we just knew then, and it was probably the worst day of our lives, really, because he said, he was crying, really. And Sister Dudley was there, who was over the oncology department, a wonderful, wonderful woman. And you could see from her face, it was holding back the tears. And he says, it's back in your liver. The bit that was left must have had precancerous cells that were so tiny that the bit we scanned after your operation, they didn't show up. But it's come back now and it's raging and it's really not a lot that we can do now. And I said, "Well, how long have I got left?" And he said, "Well, it could be months, it could be a year. We'll blast you with as much chemo as possible." And I said, "Well, do what you got to do. Do what you got to do." He said, "I'm here for as long as I'm here. And I'm going to live my life right until the very end." And so the chemo started again, quite strong chemo. But you could see that it was, in terms of fatigue, and sometimes Donna would be at our house on a Friday night and I'd come home and I'd say, "I really shouldn't go out tonight." And I'd say, "Susie, I don't think you should go to Broad Street." And I says, "We're going. If I don't go, then I might as well go in." And Donna had phoned about 11 o'clock and I'd say, "It's really, really poorly. Can you come and fetch us?" And I'd fetch her. But I'd get up and I'd go to work the next day. And I'd always be jolly. But obviously, we knew that it was a ticking clock and we'd sit and talk about it quite a lot, what we'd do. And I said to her, and this this is something that still haunts me, really. I said to her, look, whatever happens, you will go to hospital, Susie. I promise you that, you will go to hospital. And so it got progressively worse, and about three months before her passed away, I had to finish work. The kids would be, you know, the kids and the mates would be coming round every day from the work or from college or something to see if it was, and they'd bring us sweets and stuff like that. They were just the most wonderful kids in the world. Well, I mean, they were adults now, but the most wonderful kids in the world. And without them, and Donna and Martin now, who she was going with, I just don't know, you know, how we'd have coped, really. It was very, very difficult to explain to her mum and dad. I think they thought that she'd last forever. But we had to tell them that, you know, obviously her condition was getting worse and that I'd had to finish work. We were just monitoring the situation. And we used to try and go for a walk every day, but that got more and more difficult because we lived on a place called Tower Road, and it was like the side of a mountain. And things like getting her to bed became more difficult. In fact, we used to kill ourselves laughing because we'd get to the bottom of the stairs, and ours was quite steep. They were like open treads. And I'd put her arms around my neck, and then we'd literally crawl up on my belly. And sometimes we'd just stop halfway up and we'd be absolutely wetting ourselves laughing. But of course, it was dangerous. It was a really dangerous thing to do because I could have fell, she could have fell, tumbled down the stairs. And the kids were so brave then because they knew, and they were old, probably 16, 17, but they knew that they were going to lose the mum. I just kept so positive all the time until one day the district nurses come in and it was sat on the settee, and her arms were weeping with this stuff and her legs were weeping with this stuff, and they were swelling up. And the district nurses says, Susan, we need to discuss something with you. And she said, what? She says, you know, obviously your husband's taking you to the toilet, he's getting you upstairs, but we feel it's dangerous and something will happen because, you know, it's too difficult for him. I hadn't spoke to him. I think they just assumed it. He said, so what we advise you to do is we'll order a bed and we'll put it in the conservatory area, and then we can have a come out here. And I just sat quiet, so never said anything. I said, so what we'll do is, and they finished the meeting, I said, what we'll do is we'll get that organised, we'll be here the day after tomorrow and we'll bring all the stuff, and then we can get you more comfortable and also get away from this fear that you might, you know, Brian might drop you and you'll fall downstairs. And they went out the door and I thanked them and everything, come back in, and they went, if you think I am sleeping in a bed downstairs and using a commode, you got another thing coming. And I went, but Susie, you know, they are right. I might drop you, you know, even getting you on the toilet. You know, it was a case of almost carrying her to the toilet and then sitting her on the toilet because it was so weak now. And the next day I had the day off, and we sat and chatted and stuff like that. And then about mid-afternoon, I could hear somewhat different in the way that I was breathing. There was sort of a bit of a rattle. And now I know, because I've worked in special needs and dementia and stuff like that, that's the death rattle. And it was getting worse and worse. And the fluid that was coming out of her arms was almost like a yellow colour and stunk to high heaven. And then about 8 o'clock, something like that, I looked across at her, and while I was looking at her, and this is now weird on a lie, her eyes went black, completely black. Both eyes went black, like something that you'd seen in a horror movie. And that freaked me out. I really, really panicked then. And like my kids had left home by then, so it was just me and Susie. And so I found an ambulance, and the ambulance came, and they examined her and stuff like that. And I mean, really, I was probably not thinking straight, to be honest. They said, we'll take it to Sandwell, you know, follow us, we'll take it to Sandwell. And I said, well, I've got to find my kids, and I've got to find so-and-so. But I'll follow you. And they put her in the room, and there was all the wires and everything and all that going up. And then the doctor come. All the kids had come then, and mum and dad and stuff. And the doctor come, and they said, look, Mr. Dakin, we can keep Susie alive, but there'll be a problem with the brain because the oxygen ain't functioning right and this. And I said, take everything out. Take everything out now. Take all the tubes away. I don't want any tubes there. And let everybody say the good boys. And, you know, bless them, they were wonderful. They took everything, all the tubes out, and give us a lot of privacy. And the kids said the ta-ras, and the blokes that they're with said the ta-ras, and the mum and dad said the ta-ras. And then I just went in. And all I could say to Susie was, I've broke the promise. You know, that's all I could say. The only promise that I ever broke to Susie was the one where I promised her I wouldn't go to hospital. And, you know, loads of folks since have said, you couldn't have done anything, that was the best thing to do. But when you say something like that, and you don't carry it out, it's one of the things that stays with you. Various things stay with you, like Susie's ultimate favourite programme on telly was CSI Miami. And I still corsot and watch CSI Miami because, it reminds me. I can go a walk up Raleigh Bank and laugh my head off. I can sit in a cafe and laugh my head off, but I call watch CSI Miami, and very often, I mean, you put in coping mechanisms to, you know, when the dark clouds come, but they don't ever go away. Them dark clouds don't ever go away. They'll never go away, and I don't mind that, to be honest. You know, I. Folks who go and fund somebody else, that's fine. But Susie was my soulmate. Donna was her soulmate. And that triangle and my kids and all them kids who growed up with her, who seed her on her journey and supported her on her journey and were part of that journey, have growed because of her, really. And so what I'm saying is it's a massive, massive journey that you take. Don't think of it as a fight. Think of it as a journey. And that journey has got to change you and everybody around you. But if you are of the frame of mind that you and your life come first, then that journey can, in a way, and it sounds soft, but it can be wonderful. You know, I've got so many memories that I probably wouldn't have had if Susie had been healthy. And, you know, all right, it's been, 15 years, but they're as fresh as they was then. Even the bad times, even being in that office when he told us that it had come back in the liver, and seeing that bloke, seeing Dr. Spooner was wonderful. Seeing Dr. Ellis and seeing how much they cared, not only for Susie, but for life. I think that's the incredible thing about it. So going up on Raleigh Bank, my favourite place, and letting the wind blow, on my face and having a look round and thinking, you know, this is the centre of the universe, this is. And then getting them thoughts into my head and thinking, I'm going to tell a story I have. And I ate out it all. There must be loads of stuff that I've missed out. The parties, the Halifax Dues, you know, we Funny and Donna under the curtain asleep at 4 o'clock in the morning. You know, so many things, so many wonderful, wonderful memories came to the pain in a way. It sounds soft, but it was special. And I'm just glad that I've shared it with you. And I hope if anybody listens to this podcast that is just starting a journey or halfway through a journey or has even finished the journey, it might spark something that they can relate to and it'll just help them through. So, yeah, that's Walking with Susie.
The undiscovered black country, the folks don't seem to know. The undiscovered black country, where everyone should go. People walk or cycle round, they pass the time of day. The undiscovered black country has places tucked away.